You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Manuel tōku ingoa, no mai, hari mai, ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Emmanuel, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producers Toby and Theo. E whai akane coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party. I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March about the recently released housing platform and Trump's threats to destroy the Iranian civilization. Toby, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to astronomer Josh Araki about the Artemis II lunar flyby mission.
And Theo, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Patrick and Colden from the Referendum 2026 campaign on their petition to legalise cannabis and reform drug laws and policing in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces today. So get in touch, tuku patahi mai, text in on 5395. Ko wā e wareware e ahai ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ane korero anō. Hei pakehere rukiruki I mā runga I te pai. Tukutuku I irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
This morning, with negotiations continuing to stall and its own deadline for ending the war approaching, US President Donald Trump threatened civilizational destruction if Iran did not concede to US demands to open the Straits of Hormuz. Whether a sincere threat or an act of brinkmanship may remain unclear, as just before Trump's deadline, he claimed a 2-week ceasefire had been agreed to. And last week, the Green Party released their housing policy, A Home for Everyone. It takes a welfare-based approach, pitching rent controls, reversing tax breaks on the Bright Line test, and a public housing building program. So for our weekly catch-up of the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, we discuss the gravity of Trump's threats on Iran, but we begin with the Greens' housing platform. Okay, kia ora, Ricardo.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
I want to cover a few topics today. I want to cover your Homes for Everyone policy. Is that right? Homes for Everyone? Homes for Everybody?
Yeah, that's correct.
And then I also feel like it would be appropriate to comment on Trump's civilizational destruction comments on Iran. I think we should start off with the Greens policy, though. And I want you to lay out for our listeners what the intention behind the policy is. And then maybe we'll go through and clarify what some of the statements mean. And yeah.
Our country has been facing a housing affordability crisis for many years. And this means that young people are getting locked out of putting roots in the community, being able to save up for a home, and giving up on things that actually shouldn't be nice to haves and essentials in order to pay rent. So this is why we put out a plan to ensure that we can build enough public housing to clear the waiting list, also capping rent increases to 2% to ensure that wages and incomes are overall rising faster, and also getting rid of no-cause evictions, which we know have led to an increase in people being at risk of homelessness, as well as introducing what we call a rental warrant of fitness for rental homes, which is basically plugging in the gaps from the healthy home standards, which we know haven't been enough to ensure that people aren't going into flats that are moldy, that are cold, that are in poor conditions. So it's a policy package that we've actually held for quite some years, but we are recommitting to it as well.
Awesome. Okay, so there's the renters' rights bill. So that would be the cap and the reversing no-cause evictions for rental stability and the warrant of fitness. There was also the increasing public housing, which would, I assume, would be a different policy gearing, wouldn't be part of the renters' rights bill. It's been tried before. Labour in 2017 famously tried, you know, they promised a lot of public housing and people feel they undershot that.
Mm.
Do you have any ideas about how to get the ball rolling on that?
Yeah. As somebody who was extremely critical of the former government's approach to housing bills, including before I was an MP and as an MP, what we would do different is that we don't believe that the government should be basically carving out land and giving most of that land for private developments that was previously made for state housing developments. This is what we called mixed tenure housing. And this is something that the Labour government did that really, in my view, hindered the ability to deliver on adequate public housing supply. And this is why in some neighbourhoods, what we've seen is basically land that was previously only for state housing, now actually predominantly being private housing. We think this was a mistake, and it really damaged the ability to deliver on enough affordable public housing. And the key thing about public housing here is that it's public housing that people don't spend more than 25% of their weekly income on rent. So we do think that what the Labour government did missed the mark on quite a few areas. And I think the focus on Kiwi Build as opposed to public housing meant that they didn't get to deliver as much of an increase in public housing as people deserved. We acknowledge the failures of the previous government, and this is why we commit to doing differently.
And on the reversing Nationals' tax cuts, which I saw was a part of the policy, they say for landlords and property speculators. What's the difference here between this? Is there a single tax cut that's been referred to, or is it two?
Yeah, so like the Brightline test that we would bring back, and I mean, colloquially known as the sort of like landlord tax cut that was given by this government. But basically what this tells us is that, you know, the government tells us all the time that we can't afford nice things for everyday people. We can't afford adequate healthcare. We can't afford to build enough public housing. We can't afford to lift people out of poverty. But the government seemingly was able to afford losing $3 billion in revenue through these landlord tax cuts. This is why we think that actually our tax system should actually ensure that the wealthiest few pay their fair share and property speculators pay their fair share. So that is why we're committing to overhauling the tax system. If you look at our broader tax policy, we also recognize that everyday people at the moment pay a lot of tax on work, and this is why we've long called for a tax-free threshold for the first 10 grand that you earn.
Within like the existing housing policy spectrum of support that the government does provide, New Zealand does provide some amount of support compared to other countries, right? We have rates rebates, and we have the accommodation supplement, but we do have some sort of interesting quirks, right? We also have an investment tax cap of 28%, where our income tax cap is 39%. When we're talking about dealing with property speculators or investors, would this come in there, or is this barking up the wrong tree?
I think successive governments have led us to believe that governments have taken an active role in providing affordable housing, and that hasn't been the case for decades. New Zealand actually has one of the lowest proportion of public housing out of all the sort of, you know, quote-unquote developed countries in the whole world. We have very little public housing compared to other countries. And that means we also have, therefore, very little affordable public housing compared to other countries. And that's exacerbated our housing crisis. And yeah, we're effectively a tax haven for property speculators as well. These are things that are undermining our ability to deliver the right type of housing supply. We acknowledge that rent controls cannot work if you don't commit to the housing supply as well. And I do want to point out that where rent controls have, you know, supposedly failed, it's actually places where you had rent controls, you took them away, and then you saw a massive increase in rents, which actually shows that rent controls were working to prevent a big increase in rents. So I do want to point that out, because I know that other political parties have shied away from proposing a cap on rent increases. And I just want to call out the fact that where they say it hasn't worked, it's because they removed them and then rents increase, which shows otherwise.
Would the intention here then be to have a more long-term rent controls? Would that be the plan?
We should have permanent rent controls. It doesn't have to be a temporary measure, no.
Right. I want to move on, while we still have time, to what's happening in Iran. When this airs today, we'll be just past the deadline that Trump gave for reopening the Straits of Hormuz and ending negotiations with Iran. In part of that, he said a whole civilization will die tonight if Iran does not concede. How should a country like New Zealand and a society respond to a world leader, especially one as powerful as Trump, suggesting something like this?
It's an escalation of the fascist and genocidal rhetoric that Trump has carried for some years now. And I mean, it is, and I mean it when I say it's fascist and genocidal to threaten to wipe out a whole civilization. What this should be prompting us to do is to rethink our alliances with the United States, including military alliances. We should not be having military alliances with a country that is very openly and shamelessly threatening to commit war crimes and a genocide in a whole civilization. And so I think how we should be responding is by genuinely pulling out of AUKUS, of the 5-5 alliances, and actually have an independent foreign policy. We cannot call ourselves a country that respects international rules-based order if we're just allying ourselves with a country that is doing the exact opposite.
In RNZ this morning, they made a story about Winston Peters talking to US Secretary of State Marco Rubio and calling for calmer heads, for cool heads to prevail. How do you feel that the current government is responding to this? Is it appropriate? Is it inappropriate?
I don't think it meets the challenges that we're facing when Trump is literally threatening to commit war crimes and a genocide on a whole civilization. I don't think just saying that we need calmer heads is enough. I think we've reached a point of considering the consequences of having alliances with a country that is openly threatening to commit war crimes. And so I don't think we'll have much leverage by saying that people should be calm. I think our leverage comes from putting into question the military alliances that we've built over the years. And until we do so, I think the U.S. will just completely disregard our position on the international stage, because they'll see us as powerless, they'll see us as unprincipled, and will see us as just being able and willing to bootlick the United States government without any consequences for their actions, including openly threatening to commit genocide in a whole civilization, which is, the kind of things you thought that we left behind after the Second World War.
Does New Zealand have a misconception that it is less powerful or less influential than it really is? I mean, we're within the Indo-Pacific region. You know, we just struck a renewed military agreement with the Cook Islands, which was a big point of contention between China and America. Mm. It definitely feels, though, that a lot of the time we perceive ourselves to not be important, and so therefore we should keep our heads down and not respond to these things.
We often sell ourselves short on the international stage, and we've got to remember that if every country acted like their voices didn't matter on the international stage, there would be no point in us coming together and forming a rules-based order that was about peace and theoretically justice as well. And so we have a duty to stand up for human rights. We have a duty to stand against genocide. We have a duty to stand against fascism. How much our voice counts on the international stage actually matters very little. It's about taking a principled stand. If every country stops doing that, then it's a free-for-all, and we could be vulnerable to countries and big countries that just want to do the exact same thing that Trump is trying to do to Iran just because they don't like the leader. This does not mean that the Iranian regime isn't oppressive and authoritarian, but that's very different from whether a whole civilization deserves to be wiped out, basically. And that should never, ever, ever be something that is even joked about or considered.
Okay. I might tie things up here then. Is there anything you want to say, anything you want to leave our listeners with in relation to maybe the Iran stuff especially?
We as a country can not only ensure that we have a principled position on the international stage, that we stand up to the United States or to China, no matter who they are, and when it comes to making sure that there's peace and justice in this world. But equally, we can also have an economy that puts everyday people first. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. And this is what the Green Party will be fighting for us to be an independent state with our own principled positions internationally, but one that also looks after people, houses everyone, and ensures that people have dignified work available to them when they need it.
Awesome. Well, thank you very, very much for joining me.
Thank you, Manuel. Appreciate it.
That was Green MP Ricardo Menendez March discussing the Green Party's housing for everyone and the Iranian conflict and Trump's statements on that. And on that statement, I'll just read the listeners a part of The Guardian's commentary on this now. The foreign minister of Iran has confirmed that they are going to abide by the ceasefire and will be opening the Straits of Hormuz for safe passaging. We will obviously see how that pans out in the coming 2 weeks, which is the length of the ceasefire. I want to bring in my producers here. Just for the next 30 seconds, any takes? Do we feel like this was brinkmanship? Do we feel like this was always in the works? Any takes?
Well, if Trump was bluffing, then I guess it worked.
Yeah, I suppose so. Let us know your thoughts on this. Text in on 5395.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
Next up is This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us by Sparks. Look forward to your texts.
Hunting for your next guitar?
For quality entry-level strummers and a smorgasbord of used and new electric and acoustic rarities, look no damn further than Studio One Vintage Guitars.
Flash your B-card for a tasty discount and score the axe of your dreams. Plus the finest range of amps, pedals, strings and more in the land.
Find them at studio1.co.nz or head down to see the handsome devils themselves. Shop 15, Vic Park Market from Monday to Saturday. Pretty bloody nice.
What can I get for you?
Yeah, can I grab a Funky Wasp?
Smooth or CD?
Just how it comes is fine.
Son of a bitch.
So quite a complicated drink then.
What? Yeah, I'm gonna be 37.50, mate. Actually, just make it 37, because I like your attitude.
Cocktail Corner, 5:30 every Thursday on 95 BFM Drive. Thanks to the Hollywood Avondale.
Arcade Radio, Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, and advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand-affiliated radio show. Arcade Radio. For all that and music from all corners of the globe, tune in to Arcade Radio Thursday nights from 7 till 9 p.m. with Dylan Biscuit and Leon Aoki. Arcade Radio. Only on 95 BFM.
That was The Killing Moon by Echo and the Bunnymen. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. You can text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879.
The Wire.
Four NASA astronauts aboard an Orion spacecraft are currently on their return trip to planet Earth, having just conducted a successful flyby mission to the moon. The mission brought humans within the vicinity of the moon for the first time in over 50 years, and when the four astronauts passed behind its far side, they set the record for the furthest distance that any human has ever traveled away from Earth. The test mission is paving the way for a manned landing on the lunar surface, currently scheduled for 2028, and eventually a permanent lunar base. This morning, I spoke to Josh Auraki, resident astronomer at Auckland Stardome Observatory, about the past, present, and future of lunar exploration. There's a historical predecessor for this mission in Apollo 8, which was similarly a manned spaceflight which circled the moon but didn't land in preparation for the future Apollo 11 landing. Could you give us a sense of why it's necessary to do this kind of flyby mission before attempting a landing? After all, we've already landed people on the moon six times at this point. How hard would it be to just do it again?
Apollo 8 is kind of seen as the, you know, the predecessor of Artemis 2, and in many ways it is. It's a flyby mission. They have very similar kind of paths and trajectories. But I think, yeah, the main difference is that, you know, the goals of Apollo and Artemis are really different. You know, with Apollo, they were these really short-term stays, flying around the moon, testing the systems, and then eventually landing with Apollo 11. But the goals with Artemis are different because, you know, we're not wanting to go just for a few days, plant some flags and take some rocks. The goal is to eventually set up a base on the moon. You know, they actually want to have a lunar colony at the South Pole. So testing these systems is critical because, Artemis 2 is a test flight, and you know the following Artemis missions will then land. The technology obviously is way different. It's a lot safer, but it's also a lot more expensive. So they are comparable, but they're also very, very different missions in many ways.
Could you tell us a bit more about this permanent presence on the moon and the base on the South Pole?
Yeah, I mean, not just America, but I think many countries have said that they, you know, they want to go to the South Pole, and the reason for that is because if you look at the way that the moon orbits and basically the way that the sun falls on the moon, there are these places at the South Pole which are basically permanently shadowed. And in these craters, we believe that there's a lot of water ice. And, you know, water is kind of like finding gold in space because, you know, you break up water into its two main components. You get hydrogen, which is rocket fuel. You get oxygen, which is air. Or you melt it down, which is water. So it's really this massive resource. And, you know, if we go to the moon and we do have a colony there, we're not going to be able to send stuff from Earth all the time. It's really expensive. So you'll need to actually, you know, have in-situ resource management. You'll have to basically get stuff from the lunar surface that you can use. And the South Pole is the best place for that. So that's why NASA and so many other countries are wanting to set up bases there.
So in the future, the South Pole of the moon could look something like the South Pole of our own planet, where different nations have bases set up and they don't necessarily proclaim sovereignty over that area. Is that an accurate comparison?
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. Yeah, I mean, if you look at Antarctica, like you say, you've got all these countries which, you know, lay claim to areas, but, you know, no one country has sovereignty over Antarctica, and the moon's probably going to be quite similar in a sense. And, you know, all these countries, they've actually said that they want to go specifically to a place called Shackleton Crater, which is right on the lunar South Pole. But, I mean, you know, we also have a thing called the Outer Space Treaty from the Space Age. And, you know, that basically says in law that no one country can lay claim to any part of another celestial body, including the moon. But yeah, I think the politics will come into it because, you know, as United States and China or Russia, as they want to go to the moon too, I think we will have competing countries wanting to lay claim to certain places. So I think, you know, those treaties from, you know, the 60s and 70s probably will become less relevant. And I think there's going to have to be a lot of political discussion as to, yeah, how does that sovereignty work on the moon?
So on the political side of things, everyone knows that one of the main motivations for NASA to move so quickly with the lunar program in the 1960s was the ongoing space race, which was part of the larger Cold War. In the 21st century, without the looming threat of the Soviets, has the United States lost some of the motivation for ambitious space exploration projects? And do you foresee perhaps a new space race in the future, perhaps with China?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, I think the Apollo era is, you know, it was a pinnacle in human achievement and also budgets, right? So they poured a huge amount of resource and money and people into this one program, you know? And that allowed them to achieve their goals of Apollo. But unfortunately, I don't think the ambition of America has changed. But I think the budgets and the resource have, because it's been slashed and it's very, very different now. But like you say, you know, again, China has said that they want to go there, and they've actually proven time and time again that China is really an up-and-coming, you know, superpower in the space exploration. And they've said that they're going to land their own astronauts on the South Pole by the end of the decade. And I think that's likely. So I think now America is kind of turning back towards a mini space race in a sense. And they do want to beat China, and they do want to actually kind of get there first to prove that they still have that technological edge over other countries.
I feel like the Chinese lunar program isn't that well known, at least in the West. I didn't know much about it before I looked it up, but apparently the first rover was in 2013 and the most recent one was 2024. Do you have some information about that people might be interested to learn that they might not know about before?
Yeah, I mean, China's space exploration program has been incredibly successful. It's the Chang'e program. They've had multiple rovers, as you say. They've had lunar landers, and not only have they landed on the moon, they actually landed, collected samples, and brought those samples back to the Earth. So they've actually had samples from the far side of the moon, which is the first time any country has done that. So, yeah, they've proven that they're not only capable, but they can also do these things at speed and with a relatively small budget. So I think that's kind of, you know, nipping at the heels of the United States. And they're currently working on their lunar landers for crew, you know. So if we look at the speed of what they've done with robotic exploration, I think it's very likely that, they will probably get astronauts on the moon by the end of the decade.
Now, just coming back to the present mission, which I believe the astronauts are currently on their way back to Earth, as well as testing their equipment, the crew has made observations of the lunar surface and conducted experiments on board the craft. Presumably, the data which they've collected still needs to be analysed. Could you give us kind of a preliminary sense of what the astronauts have found so far?
Really, what they're doing is relaying just what they see, all of the differences, that, you know, how the light is falling on the moon, Earth shine as Earth's light falls on the moon. And also, you've got to remember, too, that they are seeing the far side of the moon. So that's the side that, you know, we can't see that from the Earth. It never faces us. So they're seeing things that, you know, no human has seen for over 50 years. And it's, yeah, a lot of it is just the images that we're seeing. I mean, just this morning, we had the Earth rise images. So we got a lot of those images showing the Earth setting and then, you know, rising behind the moon, which is incredible. And another thing that they did, which had not been done before, is that they witnessed a solar eclipse, actually. So they saw the sun go behind the moon, took these incredible photos of that eclipse, and you can see this kind of the halo or the corona of the sun behind the moon. So there's a huge amount of observational science that they're doing. But also a lot of the data, like you say, we don't have that yet. It's a pretty slow process to get all of that back, but a lot of this we will get basically once they arrive and once they've actually downlinked all of the data, you know, got the hard drives, got the memory cards, a lot of it's going to come after they get back to Earth.
I'm just struggling to visualize the solar eclipse. You mean they were on the dark side of the moon and the sun was covered from their perspective by the moon and they were in complete darkness?
Yeah, so when they went around the far side of the moon, Earth basically disappeared. So it went behind the moon for about just under an hour. And once they then re-entered or could see the Earth again, it rose again. And then at that point, as they continued to orbit around the moon back towards the Earth, the sun then went behind the moon. So they actually witnessed a solar eclipse from the moon. And it's really amazing. The photos are on NASA's website. They just came out a few hours ago. And they're really incredible because you can see the dark side of the moon, which is actually slightly illuminated by the Earth, glow from the Earth essentially, and then you can see the glow of the sun behind it. It's really incredible. It looks unreal.
That was astronomer Josh Aoraki from Stardome Observatory.
This is Bum Bum by Sis and Nancy. We'll be right back after the short break.
Tell me, say one thing, Nancy, if you understand. One thing, Nancy, if you understand. One me, they might talk about me ambition. Say one me, who they might talk about me ambition. Come and say some of them will ask me where me get it from. Tell some of them will ask me where me get it from. I told them, no, no, it's from creation. I told them, no, no, it's from creation. Bam, bam, ayo, what?
That was Bum Bum by Sister Nancy. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
Cabbage, mull, buds, dak, smoke, skunk, hash, chronic, grass, pot, cannabis. It's the fourth most used recreational drug in New Zealand, coming in behind caffeine, alcohol and tobacco. Back in 2020, alongside the general election, voters were asked in a non-binding referendum whether they supported a proposed cannabis legalisation and control bill. The vote was a close vote to no, opposing the legalisation of cannabis by only a thin margin. Currently, medicinal cannabis is available via prescription, but cannabis otherwise remains illegal to use, distribute, or produce. For this week's Get Action, I spoke to Patrick and Colden from the Referendum's 2026 campaign on their petition to legalise cannabis and reform drug laws and policing in Aotearoa, New Zealand. So, starting off, it looks like there's kind of two parts to your petition, the first being cannabis legalisation and the second being wider drug reform. So, starting off, why should we be interested in legalising cannabis?
So, I'd say the idea of legalising cannabis comes from a few things. The main thing is that when you look back to the original 2020 referendum, it was actually like a razor-thin vote, like the margin between the yes and no vote was super close, to the point where since that time and for a few years now, the number of people who pushed it over to the no vote are no longer with us for a variety of reasons, for example, which meant that if it were to happen today, then it would quite easily push over to the yes vote. And second of all, that was back when Jacinda Ardern was in government, and it was a lot of understanding that if she was to actually take a stance in favour of cannabis legalisation, drug reform, then it would have easily passed as well. So there's just that whole idea that there has always been a strong appetite for cannabis legalisation, but there was just too many people on the fence about it who otherwise would have probably been pushed towards it, And the fact is that quite a big majority, quite a big chunk of New Zealanders have at the very least experimented with cannabis before. I believe something like over 15% of Aotearoa and specifically 30% of Māori have used, in 2024 alone, used cannabis that was obtained through illegal markets. And I believe something like 80% of New Zealanders over the age of 21 have tried cannabis at least once in their lives before. So there is definitely a lot of support underground, at the very least, of supporting cannabis. But I think the fact that it remains illegal, and I'm sure Colton would agree, is what promotes its the stigma against it, based on historical factors and old traditions, especially, cultural stigma as well, that I think keeps it illegal,
Yeah, so you mentioned how, again, that was a very razor-thin margin on the referendum. I've got the numbers here, and it was 50.7% who opposed its legalisation and 48.4% who supported. So a very close result. But you mentioned how I think a lot of that opposition to it was influenced by Jacinda Ardern not personally taking a position. Now, with the current government, the National Party has historically not supported legalisation, do you think that the government coming out against it might kind of play into the opposition against it if we were to run that referendum again?
I think it's definitely one factor. But the government is not the only entity that gets to influence public opinion. And since the last referendum, a really significant report has come out of the New Zealand Drug Foundation, which is a large body of researchers on the topic, that has recommended not just the legalization of cannabis for recreational purposes, but also widespread reform to controlled substance laws. But that was a really well-researched report that shows that there's a really strong public health basis for the legalization of cannabis based on a lot of research that has been done overseas and also in Aotearoa, that it is beneficial to large number of New Zealanders who currently use cannabis sort of through illicit means, beneficial to their health and also beneficial to the health of the wider public if it were to be legalized for recreational use. Even if the government doesn't support this sort of change in legislation, we think there is widespread support among the public and among other organizations and sources of information.
Yeah, and I mean, as part of your petition, you have pointed towards expunging the records of low-level cannabis-related charges from past convictions, dropping those sentences as well. And you've also pointed towards better policing, where police can't or police shouldn't be able to search property or people on suspicion of cannabis production or intent to illicitly distribute cannabis. We've recently seen in the last 6 months roadside drug testing start to get introduced. And from the 1st of July, we're going to see THC, meth, MDMA, and cocaine testing, where police will be able to stop any driver, anytime, anywhere, and do those roadside drug tests. How would that mesh with that side of your petition towards the better policing and justice side of it?
Despite the large amount of research that has shown that these tests are not actually effective at necessarily capturing impaired drivers, as well as a lot of them just not being that effective at reducing people's appetite to use those drugs anyway, we don't really support this rollout by the government. But obviously, I think that points to the other big aspect of cannabis legalization, which is the social justice aspect, where a lot of people suffer major changes to their life and career opportunities because of something that is actually just really widespread and culturally acceptable, you know, despite it being against the law. I think most cultural groups, especially among young people, it's not considered to be really a big evil to use some cannabis. But meanwhile, if you do get caught by the police, and of course it is disproportionately Māori and members of minority groups who are being targeted by the police and going through the justice system for these kind of things, it has these really terrible impacts on your opportunities later in life, and can even, you know, really impact people's families and things. So I think a change in the legality of marijuana also needs to be accompanied with some attempts to right the wrongs of people who have been convicted in the past for low-level drug offenses, and yeah, obviously just a change to the way that police approach controlled substances as a whole. For example, not being able to search people's property on account of suspicion, and things like that, that, you know, even under legalization, if the police still have those privileges, it can continue to be used for the oppression of minority groups. So we would like to see a change in policing as well as a change in the controlled substance laws.
Yeah, and kind of pivoting from that, I guess, to your wider drug reform proposed policies that are part of your petition, there's quite a focus on transparency in policing on that side of it. Why did you focus on that aspect of drug reform?
The reason for that is pretty much that there are a lot of low-level offences that are rooted in unwarranted, like unjustified searches for cannabis when there is no substantiated evidence to suggest otherwise. So as a result, you know, the police are going to exist whether we want them to or not, right? So, and, you know, they may continue to abuse their power regardless. But what we at the very least would like to see is some sort of mechanism, some sort of evidence to try and make, you know, make that less viable for them to do. So, for example, photographic evidence of cannabis on possessed by someone would at the very least be required. And also, you know, and documenting illicit transactions to also prove, to back these charges up against cannabis users as well, if they were to believe that it was to be illicitly distributed, because, of course, we wouldn't want any charges against anyone for personal possession, obviously. And then also it should, you know, just in general be made more transparent to the public, such as through public records as well. Like that can easily be identified by anyone, and therefore there wouldn't be a miscarriage in justice when it comes to the police executing their power against people who are to distribute cannabis and drugs in general in an illegal manner.
It's essentially to give people who believe they may have been a victim of discrimination that the opportunity and the information to sort of push back against that in a court of law, that's all.
So kind of targeting that loophole of, oh, I can smell cannabis, therefore.
Yeah,
exactly. And of course that often gets unfairly, disproportionately targeted against minority groups and also Māori.
So looking forward, what are the next steps for your campaign?
I will definitely field this one, and I'm glad you've asked, because we do have a rally that is coming up in a couple of Mondays from now on the 20th of April. This will be at 12 p.m. at the Frank Kitts Park, you know, near the Wellington waterfront. And we want to try and bring out as much of a crowd as we can, because we understand this is, of course, in the middle of the day when people might be on their lunch breaks from work or between classes from uni. So, for example, if they were to be coming past the Frank Kitts Park at that time, then we would definitely invite them to come out and join us. We'll be having a few speakers, you know, be doing a rally to talk about the injustices of illegal cannabis and the effects that this has on people. I intend to be emceeing for this event as well, and we will be doing a few other events that lead up to it, such as sign making and banner making in preparation, so people can see that it's going to be quite a substantial event in favour of legalising cannabis. And of course we chose the date, the 20th of April, deliberately because, you know, 420, right? So yeah, if you happen to be around the Frank Kitts area at 12 p.m. on the 20th of April, then please come along to this. And again, we also have our petition, so we also highly would love that if you were to sign that as well.
That was Patrick and Colden from the Referendum 2026 campaign on their petition to legalise cannabis and reform drug laws and policing. You can find their petition on the Action Station website or via the link in the bio for this interview on our BCast page.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
This is Sweet Leaf by Black Sabbath. Keep it on the beat. We'll be right back.
I don't wanna be in my bag, showing no emotion when I wanna just dance. Girlfriend got me on my toes, I stand my big dog confidence getting out of hand. I get there, say what's up, it's been fried and the crowd go wild, same vibes as 09. Game 5 getting knocked out like my teeth, my dental cost ain't price as my fleece. Whip get told, pick picks with my feet, I crawl home, it's no shame, a new day. Powered by the solar, I'm blessed, don't be around bushes if I'm needing their breath. Distracted by the internet, calling my friends, like where are we headed to, a whole bunch. Stress for the crew so good, like time sets with my two-step. So big we fit, losing every inch of my pride like kid. Daydream and I stay scheming, I go south when I see pieces, so pieces fair, but nigga when I speak my meanings. Right, where the party at? I got a bone to pick with the DJ man. When I'm in the zone, I gotta pick it apart and give a breath of fresh air. Nobody coming to mind when everybody asks me who is it from the start. But the groove's so good, like time sets in my two-step.
That was Siwi Places by Ray Leslie featuring Becca Armani. And before that was Sweet Leaf by Black Sabbath. Thank you to everyone texting in, resonating with them today. And I couldn't agree more. Enroll to vote.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mo tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kororo mai ki matou mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests, the Green Party's Ricardo, Menendez March, Te Whato Stardom's Josh Araki, Patrick and Colden from the Referendum 2026 campaign. Nei ra hoki tia mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95 BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Bridge.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.